I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Steve Lambert. He's an artist and activist, and he's actually setting up on the plaza right now, today, the 4th of July, at a booth right near the KSFR booth called I Will Talk With Anyone About Anything. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And Diane Karp is with us. She's director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. And you, Steve, are a resident there.
Yes, I'm living at the Art Institute for the next 10 days.
Very nice. And welcome, Diane.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day.
We're breeding independent thought today.
Yes, we are. Breeding it. Now, I will talk with anyone about anything. So I take it you've set this up before, this kind of a table.
Yeah. I used to set it up in these kind of plazas where there would be tables where when I would walk by, I would try not to make eye contact because everyone there wanted to talk to me about what they wanted to talk about, which was usually trying to recruit me to the military or something about abortion or religion, you know, like a table that said free literature that was just like really scary because how long is this conversation going to go on? And, you know, they wanted to, you know, kind of control it. So I set up a table that said I will talk with anyone about anything so that the person passing by could, you know, like they would be the ones steering the conversation. And it turned out to be really popular.
It's so interesting because we were talking yesterday with Kirk Ellis about the media and the problem of talking and listening. There's a whole lot of talking going on and not that much listening.
Yeah. I mean, part of this, I have like kind of like curious journalist side or whatever, but it's really interesting setting up at this table. And part of what I'm doing is like, I'm going to be there for a little bit, but then other people can take my place. And so it's really just a venue or an excuse to like have conversations with strangers. And in my experience, it's worked out really well. You end up like, you know, I've had conversations about really great movies that people saw or like the Iranian Revolution or like everything in between. So
very interesting. Now, did they pick the subject?
Yeah. I mean, I let them guide it. So usually they're like really leery of me because it's like, what's this guy? Why is this guy doing this? You know, like there's a little bit of like, why are you doing this? And
right.
I'll just tell them, like, oh, I just want to talk about whatever you want to talk about, you know. And then they actually don't realize that it's much scarier for me because I'm stuck at the table and they can walk away.
Right. You know? Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you also have a piece set up at right near the Santa Fe Art Institute on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. It's right outside of Tipton Hall, and it's a big sign where people can vote. And the sign says, capitalism works for me, true or false?
Yeah, it's 20 feet wide, 9 feet tall, big metal, you know, like old-looking sign. It has a scoreboard in it, and there's a podium next to it. So if you vote true, then the number under true goes up. If you vote false, the number under false goes up. And basically, you can decide whether or not capitalism is working out for you, cast a vote, and have it recorded on the sign.
As I said to you before we went on the air, isn't there some subtlety and nuance that's possible in answering that question?
Yeah, everyone wants a third button.
Yeah.
There's just true and false.
Yes but and no.
Yeah. But that's sort of the idea, is it like forces you. If you just could say sort of, like that kind of ends the thought process. And
right.
The purpose of the sign, as much as there's like the scoreboard and the voting and the numbers and stuff, is really about getting people to consider whether or not capitalism is working out in their life for them.
Well, I think it also really, at least for me, brings up the question of when you say capitalism works for me, what do you mean by me? Is it the comforts that are in my little house, or is it the larger environment which is being destroyed?
Yeah. I mean, the way I was describing it at the lecture last night, it's like it's meant to be very simple but not simplistic, right? So this is like, everyone questions just about every word in it. They're like, what do you mean by capitalism? Like capitalism that we have now, or capitalism as a, you know, some kind of ideal form of it? What do you mean by works? Does it works in my personal life, or like, and the fact that it doesn't work for the people around me, does that count? And
what about the people who are working and not getting the value that they put into the products that they make, like all those poor souls making iPhones and stuff like that?
Yeah. So like it works because you have that phone, but like, is it really working for you if everyone that's, you know, everyone that sort of serves you in like getting these goods and services and whatever to you, it doesn't work for them. Is it really working? And so the question, you know, like I think as artists, what we can do is like kind of provoke people and get them to shift perspectives. And that's really the purpose of it, is to get people to say, all right, let me step back for a second. How is the economy working? And and working for me personally,
you know, right.
That's the important part. Because when we have these conversations about does capitalism work in the world in general, like it gets really vague and abstract, and we can, I think it just devolves into arguments, you know.
Right. Now you've set this up, I take it, in a bunch of different places. Is that true?
Yeah, it started in Cleveland last summer.
Where have you set it up?
So Cleveland, Ohio. Around Boston, a bunch of different locations around Boston, Hartford, Connecticut. Now it's in Santa Fe. Later this summer, we'll go to San Diego. Then in the fall, it's in Los Angeles, Northern California.
And what kind of numbers have you gotten? Not numbers, but what kind of votes have you gotten? Is it skewed one way or the other?
It's very split. And like I said, you know, the purpose really is these kind of conversations that come out of it. So, the way people vote and the reasons they vote are like really complicated. I've seen homeless people vote yes, vote true, that it works for them, which I tried to talk to the guy. Unfortunately, I couldn't understand still why he voted true.
Well, there were homeless people who voted for Reagan in his second term.
Yeah.
Because he believed in the idea of standing strong.
Yeah, yeah. Which that's great. I like that. I'm just not sure how I agree with how he implemented it. But the idea of standing strong, sure. But anyway, you get people like one of my favorite ones is a guy who voted true and he's like, I'm in a union and it does work for me because my union fights all the time for it to work. Or they'll say true, but it doesn't work for everyone. And so, but the stories and the conversations are really kind of a critical part of it. So part of the project is recording those through audio and video and I'm putting that together in a book, so you'll get like a picture of a person and how they voted and why they voted the way they did.
Very interesting. And so you're there basically when the machine is on and when you're able to cast your vote. It's not just that they can walk by, press the button and leave.
I try to be there a lot. Sometimes it's set up, you know, like it was at a museum in Boston. I wasn't there every day. But
so where'd you get the most yeses, capitalism works for me, and the most no, false, it doesn't work for me?
At a museum in kind of suburban Boston, a really wealthy suburb, there was a lot of people who voted true, you know, which was like not super surprising.
Right.
There was also, let's see, the most false was in front of this nightclub. I talked about this last night where the club was closing and it was like this kind of like hub of the neighborhood that held a lot of other businesses in it, like a bar and a thrift store and a record store, and it transformed this whole neighborhood in Ohio. Ran a great business. They had all these employees, but through kind of bad luck of the owning an old building and the roof going out, it was like $250,000 repair that they had to do to bring the building up to code. And so all those businesses were closing. And, you know, everyone that going to this club that night voted false.
Right, right. Now, Diane, will you also be talking with anyone about anything?
Absolutely. And the beauty of all of Steve's work is it's not about objects. It's really about making people stop and think and recalculate assumptions and interact. And so when down on the plaza, people will have a turn to both sit and listen, and there are some rules that Steve leaves on the table, or to come and chat. So you have no idea who you're going to be chatting with, or you may know who you're going to be chatting with. But the idea is to support just what you and Kirk were talking about, the ability to both listen, because that's really a critical piece, and to be comfortable picking a subject and engaging around it.
Well, I'm so looking forward to this. After we get off the air, I will go and talk to either one of you about anything. And I hope our listeners out there on the 4th of July who are enjoying the plaza do the same.
Yeah.
So check out the website, sfai.org, because the video of Steve's talk, which was fantastic, is on our website. You can access Vimeo through the website.
And
excellent.
You can see pictures of the sign and stuff at visitsteve.com.
Yes.
Visitsteve.com. Steve Lambert, artist and activist, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Bye.
We're about to hear an interview that I recorded a few days ago with Will Allen. He wrote a wonderful book called The Good Food Revolution, which you'll hear about. We are not answering the phones for our fund drive today, but if you would like to pledge online and make a contribution to KSFR, and would like a copy of this book, we have a few copies of it. So please specify when you go to ksfr.org and make a pledge that you would like Will Allen's book, The Good Food Revolution. And hey, everybody, happy 4th of July. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Will Allen. He is a farmer. He's founder and CEO of Growing Power in Milwaukee. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and he's author of the book The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be talking to you.
So you achieved success as a professional basketball player and then as a sales executive with Procter & Gamble and Kentucky Fried Chicken, but you were also always farming. How did you decide to quit the corporate world and buy the greenhouse that turned into this organization, Growing Power?
Well, back in 1993, actually Procter & Gamble was going through several restructures, and our office was in Oak Brook, Illinois, so I had to make trips down there to our office a couple times a week, and it just wasn't something I had planned to do all my life anyway, because farming has always been the legacy of my family and a passion that I had. So I had kind of two full-time jobs for many, many years as I worked off the farm, as many rural farmers do, but I also marketed my product that I grew on the farm into the city wholesale. I went to farmers markets in Milwaukee and sold it to grocery stores and that sort of thing. So I was looking for actually driving down the street one day. I was looking, not actively looking for a place, but I just came upon a sign that the last remaining farm in the city was being sold. So I was able to make a long story short, I was able to make the purchase. It's about a 3-acre facility, and my original plan was to sell my produce, because it's located between halfway between two freeways, 5 blocks away from the largest housing project, a 75-acre housing project, and very densely populated area. And you know how in business they say location, location, location. This is a food desert area, so it was badly in need of some good food. So I thought this would be a great place for me to sell my produce. And also, even though I was running it as a for-profit at the time, to add a social value to the community by providing this healthy food and hire some of the young people living in that community because they had a terrible problem with crime and so forth. So it was... even though I wasn't a nonprofit, I was kind of acting like a nonprofit early on.
Right. There was a huge change in the food production system and in distribution and in the way people ate after World War II, which led to the situation that you came into and that I sort of grew up in, which was the prevalence of junk food and fast food and things like that. What did this change look like? I mean, this was a huge sea change in food in the 20th century.
Well, it really started before the Second World War. It actually started with African-American folks migrating from the South to the North for so-called better life, better jobs. And in doing that, many folks that, of course, if you live in the South, you're engaged in farming. So leaving farming roots to move to the North, in that transition, folks left behind a lot of the skills. They didn't pass on the skills as they moved to these northern cities to the next generations, and that's where the break really happened. So people moved into these neighborhoods. As these neighborhoods started to decline, of course, segregation, and people were boxed into certain neighborhoods where there wasn't a lot of really healthy food. Folks started eating fast food and processed kinds of food from corner stores, and people's health started going south, and diabetes and heart disease became a part of what was happening, and it continues today in obesity that has reached almost epidemic proportions now. So it really started with not passing on the art of farming, the art of growing food, the art of taking care of your our basic, your most basic need that keeps us alive, and that's eating healthy food. Because people that eat really good food that has a full nutrient impact, all studies show that they live longer, and they don't have the diseases. So people started paying a very heavy price for eating food that, first of all, didn't taste very good, but also didn't have any nutrients in it. And it really transcends just today, as far as I'm concerned, not just in low-income areas, but everybody's eating food that's not as good as it was 50 years ago when we had our soil fertility was 50% more fertile and so forth.
Well, you also had farmers selling directly to supermarkets in a way that is not so common anymore.
Absolutely. I used to be able to sell my produce. I would call a produce manager, and he would order, say, 30, 40 cases of this or 20 cases. I could deliver that directly to the supermarket, and that stopped, I would say, in the late 80s, that kind of stopped because the wholesalers, they set up wholesale divisions in all these major grocers, and they became profit centers for the corporation, and they pretty much told their stores they had to buy from headquarters, and they started shipping full truckloads from California, and us local farmers, small farmers, couldn't match that kind of situation where we would be able to ship a whole truckload into a warehouse. So it kind of knocked out many, many, many farmers just went out of business because their primary business was wholesale.
Now, you grew up living close to the land and to the food you eat, and you had the good fortune to carry a lot of generational wisdom and, as you call it, the art of farming into your current life, your current work. And even though it was hard work at the time and maybe not all that much fun, and as you say, you don't really want to romanticize it. On the other hand, you have this knowledge that you can pass on. What was your childhood like, and what was your relationship to the food that you ate?
Well, my parents were both sharecroppers, and unlike many African American, like I said before, parents or families, my father especially wanted to pass on the art of farming to me and my brothers, which is a real gift that I'm very thankful for today. But like you said, back when you're a teenager or you're grade school, high school, you know, I was kind of born into this farming. So it really started when I was very young. So being immature as you're growing up, you think all your friends are having a good time and you're out in the summer working on the farm before you could go out and play ball or whatever. So at 18, when I left the farm, I said, never again will I do this hard work because I'd missed out on, I thought, so much stuff that my other friends are having all this fun and going out and staying out late at night, and I had to be in at 8:30. I even had this nickname my teammates used to call me, oh, come on, come out with us, you know, and then they would tease me and call me in early, you know, because I had to be in early, you know, because that was part of what my parents expected. So when I got over to Europe, the last place I played professional basketball, after going through college and playing professional basketball, I helped one of my Belgian teammates on their farm one day, and I realized that this is what I wanted to do. That was a transformative moment to get back into farming after taking a short breather, so to speak.
This book, The Good Food Revolution, is part autobiography. It's part the story of growing power and your urban farming projects. It's part inspirational. It's part how-to book for people who want to do this. And I felt when I was reading it like I got to know so many people and grew to kind of have this, just through reading, this community of wonderful people. And we don't have time to talk about them all, but Tell us for a moment about Hope Finkelstein and how the two of you came together and shared your strengths.
Well, you know, Hope had started an organization in Madison. It was just a beginning organization, and I invited her to a little retreat that I had. My organization at the time was called Farm City Link, and my idea was to link my rural background with the urban, linking the city with the country kind of a thing. And she came up with this name of her organization was called Growing Power. So we decided, because of her strength of writing grants and my strength, of course, is training as an educator in farming, to combine our forces. And we had to dissolve one of the organizations. I really like the name Growing Power, so that's how what we stuck with. And kind of I started growing that out. Unfortunately, she had to leave. Her husband was working in Alaska, so she had to resign shortly after that. It was a situation where we had very little money. Nobody would give us funding. But I don't come from a nonprofit background, so I said, well, nobody will give us money. Let's go and sell some products and services. So that's how we survived, and that's how we survived today. Over 50% of our pretty large budget now is derived from selling products and services, over 40 income streams that we have coming into Growing Power that we generate ourselves. We also write grants for programs and so forth. But I'm a farmer, and it's a urban farm of over 200 acres and 23 farms now, and it's growing every day as we build out greenhouses that will cover about 100 acres of greenhouses over the next couple of years. So that we can have this healthy food and distribute it to everybody in our community, not just low-income people, but everybody. The same food has always been my dream, and the way that I grew up is that we would share food from our farm to our family, extended family, friends, and we would sell a bit of it too. So I'm basically doing the stuff that my parents were doing way back in the 50s and 60s.
We're talking to Will Allen about his book, The Good Food Revolution. There were very difficult times financially when you were starting out, and this is a story of tremendous resourcefulness. It's just fascinating that you were reusing all kinds of things, old ink vats, beer mash, wood chips. Tell us some of those stories.
Well, I grew up on our farm. We grew everything naturally. We didn't use any chemicals. We didn't call it organic back in those days, but I consider our practices that we did then and we do now beyond organic standards. Much higher than the organic standards that are today. So it's always been a part of my farming background. And to be able to use resources and to be able to improve the environment and to compost on a pretty large scale. This year we'll do 40 million pounds of food and carbon into high quality, thousands of yards of high quality compost that we grow all of our food in. We have no digging equipment. We use only new soil that we grow. So we grow soil to be able to grow this healthy food.
And the soil comes from basically food waste, of which there's a huge amount, this beer waste, cardboard waste, and worms.
Yes.
And all those things put together make soil.
Well, what we do is we compost. Of course, you need carbon and nitrogen. Nitrogen side has food waste. If you're in a rural area, you would use animal waste, but because we're in a city, there's thousands and thousands of pounds of food waste that goes in the landfill every day. So we're able to build relationships with folks that have a lot of food waste. And brewery waste is also a nitrogen source from the breweries, and we're in a city that has a lot of breweries. So we compost over 100,000 pounds of brewery waste every week, and we'll be doubling that with getting some from Miller Brewery, which is the last remaining large brewery in our area that uses two silos of grains a day. So we'll have all that waste in the future as we expand our operation of growing soil, because the existing soil is contaminated. So we put 2 feet of new soil on top of the existing hardpan clay or on top of asphalt and concrete, and we grow our food. So So it's using the resources that are there that should be go back into Mother Earth. And then we add the worms that are remediators, and worms create fertilizer, the best organic fertilizer, arguably, in the world. So we have 7,000 pounds of worms on the one farm. We started out with 30 pounds of worms years ago, and it's grown just on that farm. And we have worms on our other farms in a compost operation. So we have all of these worm nurseries or depositories, if you want to call them that, on all the farms.
There's such an important, there's so many important lessons from the work that you do, and one of them is seeing how all the different kinds of food that you're growing relate to each other. So, for example, you started growing fish, and that led to, well, tell us about it. I mean, tell us about this whole aquaponics, the fish waste fertilizing the plants, and then the heat from the fish pools making other plants possible. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, we one of the things that we do is aquaponics. Aquaponics is the act of growing fish and plants in the same system, and the plants remediate the waste of nitrogen. There's a process that fish waste goes through from comes out as an ammonia product, and it goes through the transformation, and the plants actually take the nitrogen, the bad stuff, out of the water, and the plants grow. And you're able to sell the plant product a lot earlier than you get the fish, because it takes a year for the fish to grow out. So you're getting income already from these systems that are, some of them are 10,000 gallons to grow 10,000, say, tilapia, yellow perch. And that started many years ago with the 355-gallon drums. So I was able to engineer into larger systems using very little energy input. One pump actually operates the whole thing, and we use gravity to move the water into a closed system that doesn't require putting water. So it's a water conservation system as well, but it also doubles. We heat the water, and it's a much more efficient way of heating a greenhouse by heating a 10,000-gallon mass of water versus if you had forced air heating system that you'll find in most greenhouses. So we've been able to cut our energy, our fossil fuel use in half by using that. And plus we have solar panels now that provide a quarter of our energy, electrical energy, and we have a solar hot water system that provides 70% of our hot water to heat these large system water systems in our greenhouses. So we've been able to cut our energy cost, which is really goes to the bottom line of reducing your production cost to be able to pass that on to our customers. If you're able to grow your own soil, your own energy, then you can really cut the cost, and you can get the price of this, like I said, beyond organic food to folks. And match the conventional price of food, conventional food that's grown with chemicals. So if we're able to do that, then we can really distribute that food in a distribution system that we've been able to, a scheme that we've been able to, I've been working on for over 30 years. So we're able to get our food to everybody in our community that way. But it's really important that we look at these systems and the work that we do as social justice work and food justice work, because everybody should have the right to have this healthy food, not just certain aspects of our community. So we make sure that our food gets distributed to everybody in our community.
Tell us more about the human aspect of it. First of all, did you see people's tastes change as they started eating healthier food, and how did you see their lives change at the people who are working with you?
Well, one of the things that I think is a big misconception is that everybody always talk about people's taste buds changing. It's really not the case. If you talk to any kids, and which I do all the time because we have youth corps, you know, a large youth corps at our organization, and I work with thousands of kids from the public schools and private schools, and really all over the country that come to Growing Power. kids know what good food is. You know, they always tell me when I say, when's the last time you had some good food? And they say, well, when I, at Thanksgiving and a religious holiday or the 4th of July or Labor Day or, you know, those major holidays, kids know what good food is. It's an access issue. It's about not having access to it on a regular basis. Kids know what good food tastes like. They just don't have access. And probably the place they have least access is in their schools, because our school system has some of the worst food because of the amount of or lack of money that's given per meal per student, which in Milwaukee is $2.84 because of all the expenses, not just the food expense. The food is about 80% only. So the rest of the cost of getting that food to the kids and all the infrastructure is about $2. So that pretty much tells you the story of the kind of food that our kids get to eat.
Now, part of what you've done is you've gotten good food into some of the schools. Is that right?
Yes, we've been able to do that in partnership with Milwaukee Public Schools, as well as the food, the person that delivers the food, which is Sysco, one of the largest food wholesalers. They're the only vendor that's allowed to deliver food in most of the school systems in around southeast Wisconsin. And Milwaukee Public Schools, being the largest school district in the state, they deliver food. So we had to develop a relationship and partnership with them and MPS, and also a wholesaler who does some of the processing of the carrots. So we were able to grow 100,000 pounds of carrots that went into the Milwaukee Public Schools. They actually used 250,000 pounds, and we're growing that out this year for this upcoming school system, upcoming school year, as well as a salad mix and sprouts that we give the kids for an afternoon snack in the elementary school level.
Now, you talk in the book quite a bit about the economics of food and the kind of smaller scale urban farming or even kind of organic small scale rural farming are not economically viable, and yet you are so much more resourceful and so much more, so use so much less energy and do so much more recycling, and it seems like a much more efficient and economical way of doing things. Why is it not competitive with agribusiness? Is it simply because of the subsidies, the economies of scale? What's going on?
Well, a lot of the larger, of course, everybody knows that if they weren't subsidized, they wouldn't be in business, a lot of these farms. So it's kept them in business for many years, and now that because the prices of corn and soybeans and other things have really spiked, some of those large farming infrastructures that produce a lot of the processed foods and food for animals and food for grain, for ethanol and so forth, they're really prospering now. But what's kept them in business, and it's not a sustainable thing because we know that prices will change. So they're living on good times right now, but we know that it's always been that way, where you have spikes where they do very well, and then you get to those low periods, and then that's when the supports come in, whereas us vegetable farmers, they say, you know, we're growing a high-value crop. We don't need subsidies, which is totally ridiculous because we need to grow farmers. We don't have enough farmers to grow all this healthy food that now all of a sudden everybody wants. So that's a part of the issue, to be able to take some of that money from the commodity end of it and put it into sustainable agriculture. It's what we need to do, and this farm bill is an opportunity for us to try to do that, is to shift some of that money out, because we really need to train some farmers. We need some farmer training programs, like we're training 1,000 farmers a year, but that's a drop in the bucket. So we need to have more funding for different organizations around the country that want to train farmers, and those farmers won't necessarily come from the rural communities. Those farmers will come from our universities and these thousands of youth ag programs around the country, and there are thousands of them. Many of those young people want to become farmers or participate in the food system and one of the over 100 different categories of jobs that are going to be available, like renewable energy, finance, and planning, and architectural designs, and that sort of thing. So it's a tremendous opportunity. I look at it as a tremendous opportunity, but we do need some help. Even though this is a grassroots kind of a movement, it's now a revolution because everybody wants to get involved all of a sudden over the last 5 years. And I think the First Lady has had a lot to do with that in terms of putting that garden on the White House lawn. They estimate that 10 million new people started growing food for the first time after she did that. And our Let's Move program, I had an opportunity to work with her on, has really grown some long legs and is really moving a lot of people. And the way that the First Family looks in terms of being healthy and the fact that they talk about eating organic food all the time really has changed a lot of things and changed a lot of people, especially people of color.
You talked before about the hidden costs of junk food, fast food, bad food, namely the illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, and so on, that are caused by long-term eating of these foods. What about social problems? Do you feel like some of the actual social problems that we see in our communities, rich or poor, are caused by the food we eat?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the foods that we eat, the kids can't really learn. They go to, many kids don't, first of all, stop at the candy store on the way to school. They don't have breakfast. They're late to get the school, free school breakfast program. Even though if they're there on time, the food is so awful, they don't eat it. So we have all kinds of issues around that. But if you're not well nourished, you tend to do things that are not so healthy, whether it's participate in crimes or whatever. But we know that communities that are well nourished have less crime. So it becomes a crime fighting tool. It also, this new food system that we're growing can really grow a lot of jobs. We've proven that. Starting out many years ago, now we have 115 employees, and we're going to add another 150 over the next year or so. So we know that if you build an infrastructure and scale it up, you can grow jobs because people are going to eat, and people want to eat local food. 86% in the last survey said that they would rather eat locally produced food than food that's shipped in because of all the issues that have come up in the last few years that we could talk about for the next 2 or 3 hours. But I think it's a tremendous opportunity for folks to participate on some level in, like I said, hundreds of different categories of jobs, and thousands of jobs will come out of this local food systems as we develop them around the country.
You worked with Kohl's department store and then with Walmart and took a grant from Walmart for which you got some negative feedback from some progressive communities and so on. Tell us about your work with these large corporations. On the one hand, they seem to be doing a lot of harm in the world, and they are the kind of the essence of the store that ships food in from far away. On the other hand, as you say, they're made up of people.
Yeah, they're made up of people, but also I think a lot of people that write these things don't have all the facts in terms of many of these corporations are separate from the foundations are totally separate from the practices of the corporations. And I don't think we really research a lot of these corporations. I'm not trying to defend any of them because you can go back to the Civil War days when almost every northern insurance company provided funding for slavery. So are we going to go back and criticize all those insurance companies that exist today and say we're not going to support them or do anything or buy their products? No. Walmart just happens to be the company of the day that folks can write about and blog about and so forth. But there are many other companies. Like Kohl's Corporation has a wonderful giving program. Both of those companies, their foundations, are doing tremendous. As a matter of fact, when you think of Walmart and you talk to the farmers that I know in the South, without Walmart purchasing their crops, these African-American farmers especially, they're growing sweet potatoes and other edible crops, and okra and all those southern peas and things down in the south. The Walmart wasn't there as a company that would purchase this stuff. They wouldn't be in business. You can talk to them. Those are the people that I talk to. The funding that we received, most of it is geared to pass on to those farmers to help support their operations and give them training so that they can upgrade and change some of their farming practices to more sustainable practices. So one day we need to be able to walk into a Walmart store and have a section in a Walmart store that says locally grown produce. And every Walmart store and every retail grocery store, we don't have that today. So we should be setting those kind of goals and working toward that. And we need everybody on board to be very positive. And the other thing that a lot of people don't understand is every corporate company today has a sustainable mission and have hired people to improve their sustainability. So we need everybody at what I call the Good Food Revolution table. It doesn't make sense to not have everybody there. We can influence some of these companies to change some of their practices by educating them. But they need to be at the table. If we kick them away from the table, there's no way that we're ever going to have this opportunity. So we took a little bit of flack, but way more positive comments I received than the little flack that I took from folks that sit around and blog and talk about. They need to come out. What I always say is they need to come out into these communities and really see the conditions in America, because we have some terrible situations that affect all of us. These negative, non-sustainable situations in these communities affect everybody, and we need everybody's help to rebuild these communities. And food is the number one thing.
Well, I mean, what you did in Kohl's department store, for example, growing food right next to their stores on like these grassy medians by the parking lots and things like that. And then the daycare kids were learning to garden, and then this food was served in the cafeteria. And it was so, for me, reading it, it was so creative and just in a way so easy once you see it that something could be done anywhere.
Well, you know, the work that we do at Growing Power, and it's always been from like my legacy, is that it's to not just sit around at a table and talk about this stuff. It's to go out and do something, to get started, to build something, and that's what we do. And 9 times out of 10, these things turn out, or even higher, turn out to work, because along the way you're going to tweak it and make it work and build relationships is one of my strengths. But you have to have something concrete. You have to do something concrete. People, we've been able to change policy in our city and our state because we have a concrete work that I can take policymakers and show them that this works. And then they start looking at this as an asset to the city. And obviously, Growing Power has become a huge asset to Milwaukee. Over the last 6-7 years, we've generated over $15 million through the conferences and gatherings that we brought into the city. This year in September, we'll have probably the largest urban ag conference, a national, international conference of 3,000 people. So we bring in a lot of dollars to the city, and you start getting looked at in a very positive way, that urban agriculture is something that especially in our city with all the vacant land and buildings, becomes a very positive thing that builds our communities and brings people together and creates jobs and creates income for our city, because all these cities are suffering. So being able to create jobs and put people to work is a very positive thing, and pay them a living wage, which is part of our piece around social justice, is to make sure people are paid well, that they can make a living and they can live a good life. You know, everybody always talks about this middle, all the politicians talk about this middle class kind of lifestyle that's kind of gone away. Well, one of the things we need to do is have these companies like ours is to pay people a living wage so that they can live that lifestyle again. And crime goes away. When people have their basic needs met, crime goes away.
Right.
You know, when they don't, And I remember Secretary of State Clinton told me at the White House once that the next wars will be fought over lack of food and water and be disguised in all kinds of ways. But when people's basic needs aren't met, they revolt and all kinds of chaos happens. So if we can do that, if we can start building these true sustainable communities, and food can be the catalyst for that. You know, because all of these cities talk about their 2020 plans to be green and sustainable, but if they're not able to have a sustainable food system, they'll never reach those goals in 2020.
What are your hopes for the food system on a national level? Are you looking at it in those terms? In other words, can agribusiness eventually give way to more sustainable farming, in your view?
Yeah, I think what's going to happen, if I had to look in a crystal ball and see all the, we have to take all of this enthusiasm, because I can't call it true passion at this point. I call it enthusiasm, because people have to be tested in terms of, do you really want to do this work? It looks good. You know, it looks real, you know, fun and good, but the farming, and you can talk to any farmer, is not always fun. But these farmers are so deeply passionate about their work, and that's what keeps them farming, is the fact that this work is extremely hard. It's much harder to be a successful organic farmer than to be a professional athlete that we look up to. All these professional athletes that kids look up for, well, it's much more, much harder. And if you go to other countries, those farmers are put on a pedestal. They're on that same level as professional athletes, or soccer stars, or doctors, or engineers. They're on that same level. But in America, we've always kind of downgraded farmers and looked at them and teased farm kids that went to school and bullied farm kids and so forth, where farming is an art form, especially this kind of farming, this new kind of more creative kind of farming that we're doing. Will it replace the industrial food system? No. But what we need to do is to give people choices. When they go in the grocery store, do I want to buy this locally grown food? Right now, it's not available in large quantity. We need to increase that. If we increase that in Milwaukee, which is our goal, to 10% over the next several years, couple years, you're talking about 10% less trucks coming in from California, Texas, or Florida. Environmental change, that'll be more than 10% more jobs around the system. Environment improves. All positive things happen with a local sustainable food system. So the only way to make that work is to get everybody on board, because it really does take everybody on board to be able to even have a composting operation. And a large composting operation that grows good soil in every major city. So the way that we're doing it is we have these regional training centers around the U.S. We have 15 of them, where we link with organizations and help them build the infrastructure and replicate some of the things that they learn at Growing Power into their own cultural way that works for their communities.
Will Allen is a farmer. He's the founder and CEO of Growing Power in Milwaukee. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and he's author of the new book, The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. And, everybody go out and help grow the Good Food Revolution.
Excellent.